Don Berwick has great lines. One of his great lines is this: a system produces the results it is designed to produce. If you want to create a system, let's say at a departmental level, where you have employee ownership, you have peer-to-peer kind of pressure on performing quality stuff, then to me, that means you need some way to engage that front line.
Welcome to the Cold Steel Surgical Podcast with your hosts, Amir Farouk and Chad Ball. We've had the absolute privilege of chatting with some amazing Canadian as well as international guests over the past year. While the topics have been broad in range, whether clinical, social, or political, our aims for the podcast continue to remain the same. We hope to inspire discussion, creativity, scholarly research, and career development in all Canadian surgeons. We hope you enjoy our second season as we continue to highlight some incredible guests, deliver detailed masterclass sessions on a myriad of clinical topics, and introduce some fresh new features such as debate and companion formats. We hope you relish the podcast as much as we do.
Wander into one of the operating rooms at the Ottawa Civic Hospital and hear a discussion about colorectal surgery, Plato, and Drake happening simultaneously, you could be pretty sure that you were in the OR of Dr. Hussein Malou. Dr. Malou is a duly trained, minimally invasive, and colorectal surgeon in Ottawa. We had the pleasure of speaking with the Renaissance man about the impressive quality improvement initiatives he has led in Ottawa, as well as his thoughts on the unique shared practice model in the Ottawa Colorectal Group. True to the advice he shares at the end of the podcast, Dr. Malou continuously remains fresh and was actually recently named the Maiden Director of Planetary Health at the University of Ottawa. This was such an enjoyable conversation. So without further ado, Dr. Malou.
Can you tell us about where you grew up and what your training pathway looked like?
Yeah. So I grew up in Toronto. I guess, you know, a lot of people don't talk about their educational experiences prior to their training. But let me tell you that mine was kind of, I think, life-shaping, because I went to this, and take this in the best way possible, it's kind of like this gifted high school, okay? It was called UTS, University of Toronto School. And back then it was semi-private, so, you know, you wrote this exam, you got in, somehow I got in. I assure you, I was at the bottom of my class. And the thing, though, that, and the reason why I bring it up is to say that I was humbled, basically, when I went there. And my friend group that I continue to interact with, they kind of, you know, it's great. You get introduced to this incredible milieu of people who inspire you and have continued to kind of do that for me. So I'll tell you, for example, and I'll get to my training in a second, but, you know, like one of my buddies, he was like, you know, you must have seen in the media, like that million species going extinct, that whole study from the, you know, UN on biodiversity. He was like the Canadian lead on that. Wow. You know, like, and so, you know, just doing these incredible things. Another guy's a New York Times bestselling author. You know, he actually wrote an article for Roscoe. Another buddy of mine is like taking the year off just because, you know, he's been COO of this and this and that, and he's done incredible things, and he just kind of follows what is kind of fulfilling to him. So I'm kind of surrounded, and I could name more people, like, so, you know, like, but it's just to be surrounded by that from that age was good. And it really humbled me and made me realize, you know, I'm not very smart. And so then, you know, I end up going, doing my undergrad at Western. I did my gen surge and medical school at Western as well. And, you know, I wasn't one of these people who had any clear path in front of me. I had done zero research as a medical student or in my first 2 years of residency. And then I sat down with a program director and said, hey, I want to do laparoscopic surgery. It kind of seems like maybe that's where things will go with certain things. And I want a big community job maybe. And I think that would be a good fit. So they said, well, you know, we're going to hook you up with like some research with what we think, and I don't want to offend anyone here, but what they thought was, like, at that time, they thought it was a great program, and it was Dr. Poulin, Dr. Matza, and Dr. Shalakta in at St. Mike's in Toronto. And they were kind enough to let me do research with them in third year, which kind of then set up my trajectory to do MIS, which I ended up doing in Ottawa because Matza and Poulin moved to Ottawa. And then after that, colorectal fellowship, and and then kind of from there, just tried to continue to learn after that. So
yeah, that was an interesting group at the time, hey? Like some real pioneers in terms of Canadian MIS surgery, and a heavyweight collective for sure.
Absolutely.
I wanted to shift gears here for a second and talk to you about quality improvement, because that's clearly a huge passion of yours and something you're well known across the country for, particularly in the colorectal circle. You know, the first question I want to ask you is maybe a bit of a basic one, but I feel like quality improvement is this, again, a nebulous sort of term that might mean a lot of different things to a lot of different people. So what exactly does quality improvement mean to you?
At its very general level, you know, what I really like when I think about quality improvement is throwing the C in front of it, like, you know, the CQI, the continuous quality improvement. And that, I think, is anything at the end of the day, at its most basic level, and whatever you can do to reduce harm to patients. And so then, you know, when you take that and you go to something more, I guess, definitive, like, you know, I think the IHI quadruple aim, for example, touches on some very kind of big piece of that. So when you think about that, there's, you know, patient experience, for example, like that, if they have a terrible patient, if there's a terrible experience, that's patient harm. You know, when we talk about doing these things and reducing costs, I think that within our current context and the context we are going to be, our health system is going to be in within our lifetimes, I think for sure, like, reducing costs is a really big thing. The public health part of it, I think, is really big, that I've continued to hopefully understand more. And, you know, I went back to school and just did a master's in public health, which I just graduated from in November. And then, like, the whole thing with, like, you know, the healthcare team as well. Like, I think we see, you know, especially with COVID now and things like that, like, there's a significant kind of mental health hit that people take with going through all these tough times. And so I think all those things kind of play into it really well. But at the end of the day, to me, it's a lot of, you know, it's patient and team centered and reducing harm to both those parties.
So what kind of motivated you to get interested in QI? Was that something that you were working on as a resident, as you mentioned, or how did that kind of evolution come into play?
Yeah, so it's like most things with me, right? I don't really have forethought. You know, I think, you know, all of us kind of want to offer the best care to our patients. And so we were in NISQIP, which I think everyone knows about. So NISQIP had shown that our hospital, specifically like colorectal, had like really high morbidity driven by a high SSI rate. And actually, we saw that across our whole department. And, you know, I was kind of tapped to do QI stuff for our division. And so that's really how it happened. It wasn't because I was like, oh, I have a real interest in this. It was more the division head going like, yeah, here's a guy kind of in his, you know, kind of junior guy in the division. I'm going to tell him to do QI. But it was interesting, like Dr. Poulin at that time, he told me, and Dr. Poulin told me a lot of really smart things. But he said, you know, QI is going to sustain you into the future. Mark my words. And lo and behold, I mean, it really is one of the things I enjoy most and makes my career fulfilling. So he was right. Thank you, Dr. Poulin.
I want to get back to the QI work that you've done and dig a little deeper into the work that you did subsequently. But I just want to pause and note something that, you know, you talk about the fact that you sort of took these suggestions from your mentors and kind of ran with it and went with it. And we've had guests on the show that, you know, we always ask this question about what people might have done differently or what advice they would give to themselves as a resident. And a lot of people have said, you know, I would have been more deliberate in what choices I made. But I think there's some role, as you've clearly shown, for kind of being open to the possibilities, particularly early on. And it's curious, is that sort of how you approach your career a little bit, as you kind of have this sense of openness to possibilities? Or do you think sort of now as you advance maybe towards sort of a mid-career point that you're a much more deliberate about picking what kind of career choices you want to make?
You know, there's some people, I think, because virtue of their intellect, drive, interest, you know, I think of, I'll give you an example in Ottawa, you know, Rebecca Auer, like what a great researcher, right? Like she's like an inspiration to so many people, including me. And I go like, wow, like, you know, it'd be awesome if I could, you know, delve down to a level where I can start figuring out how to cure cancer. But you know what? Like, I'm not that smart. So I'm going to go with my strengths and I'm going to take like the, you know, I don't know if you've come across this book by David Epstein. It's called Range. And, you know, he talks about the fact that, you know, it's okay for some people to have like a lot of different areas that they find interesting. For me, QI is like an outlet to a whole bunch of different things. And so that's what I've been enjoying, you know, is kind of just trying a lot of different things, and I enjoy them. And as long as I'm enjoying them, I don't know. I think I'm not, I have still not become deliberate, is the answer to your question.
Well, it gives a person like me hope, because I have eclectic interests, as you know. And so I quite take that advice to heart. But let's go back to the QI stuff. So you got tapped by Dr. Poulin to be like the QI person in your department. And then you went ahead and you just ran with that. And across the country, I think it's safe to say that you're well known for developing some very innovative programs at or in Ottawa, particularly the Comprehensive Unit-Based Safety Program, or CUSP. Can you tell us about CUSP and what was involved in generating that?
Sure. So, you know, again, I started off for our division, actually. So it was just general surgery. And, you know, I knew nothing, right? So for 6 months, I'll be honest, like I did nothing. Like there was an SSI rate and I had no idea how to move that forward. So by that point in time, you know, we talked about the fact, like, you know, 3-year undergrad, 4 years med school, 5 years gen surge, 2 years of fellowships, or I guess three years of fellowship plus a master's in EPI, right? So I had all this education, I really couldn't move the needle. I didn't even know how to. And so we end up, the hospital's getting kind of worried at this point in time because they've been in NISQIP for 2 years prior to this and the needle hasn't moved either on that. And they're worried maybe, you know, it's going to get out somewhere and, you know, everyone's going to look pretty bad because we had this data and nothing happened. They'd really tried a kind of top-down approach, which hadn't really resonated or been effective. And so they end up paying, like they give like each of the division leads, like they're like, here's like $1,000 to go to this NISQIP conference. So I go, I sign up really late. There's like I was like, I'm going down at Salt Lake City. Hey, Salt Lake City maybe is super exciting to a lot of people, but I mean, no one told me it was super exciting. So I was like, I'll sign up for like a workshop. And the last workshop available was the only one that was available, something called Comprehensive Unit-Based Safety Program. It's CUSP. And it's run by Johns Hopkins. And so I go to that and it's like a half day thing. And so I'm listening and I'm like, wow, it's like, this sounds pretty simple. Like it makes sense. Like basically you take a multidisciplinary team, you get an executive sponsor for that team. You do it unit-based, which kind of made intuitive sense to me. Like, you know, for example, you do it on an inpatient floor, you do it for like, let's say colorectal surgery in the OR, yeah, do it for HPV surgery in the OR, for example. And you meet on a regular basis and you generate ideas. And it just so happened that the department chair of surgery, like the interim department chair, who was just switching that time from Dr. Poulin and Dr. Sundaresan happened to be sitting there with me in that thing. And we're sitting there, we're going like, this kind of makes sense to us. So come back and, you know, I got this small grant to kind of start off three teams in colorectal surgery, in on the general surgery inpatient floor at the two main inpatient hospital sites. And it, And like we got, you know, we basically start this process by asking two simple questions. It's like, you know, how's the next patient going to be harmed? And what can we do to prevent it? And we also threw in, we kind of cheated and we made like four questions. Like, how do you think the next SSI is going to happen? And what can we do to prevent it? And we gave it to everyone, like housekeeping, because these are the people who are on your team. Housekeeping, OT, PT, frontline nurses, residents, surgeons. You know, there's probably some names I'm forgetting here, but like, yeah, like we distributed widely. We got a bunch of ideas. Those ideas started our teams rolling. We picked some quick win things. And all of a sudden, you know, again, it's the first time, like people were a bit skeptical, but it was the first time. If you think about it, I don't know how often this happened to you, but at that point in time, it was the first time for a lot of people that a frontline nurse sat down with a surgeon in a meeting for like an hour that was dedicated to patient care. And for there to be OT and PT there and a resident and everyone's discussing what can we do to make things better, that really resonated with people. And like became a powerful thing. And then it spread. So went up to like, you know, 17 teams and we developed some infrastructure around that and, you know, tried to share those lessons that we learned with other places. And then the Sontario Collaborative came along, so we were able to kind of share it there. And there was a BC Collaborative that already existed. So, you know, we kind of shared what we had done there. And so it's just, you know, it's one of those things again, like most things, man, like, I didn't come up with that idea myself. I just kind of took it and tried to adapt it for our context. And it, you know, it happened to work. Like I knew we had kind of made it when on the surgical safety checklist. Now we have something in Ottawa where it says like, are there any cuss measures for this case? And, so, you know, that was kind of nice to see, but again, that's like, you know, that's a team effort. And again, I think that's where that humility from going to UTS came in handy. I realized I'm not that smart to come up with ideas and solutions. That sitting down with people and getting people to, and it's, I mean, that's supported by evidence too. Multidisciplinary teams are better than kind of uni specialty teams in terms of coming up with solutions and having mixed demographics, et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, all that to say, it's led to a lot of different things. And if I can still drone on a little bit more, it's gone on to like stuff like beyond SSI and stuff like that, opioid reduction. Our big thing last year is looking at reducing our carbon footprint. You know, we did a thing on measuring surgeon empathy. So like it, that's where like, then again, I'm using kind of QI to explore things, which I think really matter, like the climate crisis. So, yeah.
Can you give us an example of something that came out of the discussion from with these different groups that you wouldn't have necessarily thought of if you hadn't kind of changed the approach? Because I think fundamentally, and again, just like all great ideas, they sound simple when someone presented, but like obviously you had to clearly recognize that this was the approach to take. But you know, the fundamentally, I think what you did differently is you made it much more granular and much more about what everyone's frontline experience was, and you could leverage what people's real expertise was and all these different facets to come up with a plan that perhaps people hadn't seen before. So can you give us an example about something that came up from those discussions and turned into an initiative that you wouldn't have seen otherwise?
Sure. So, you know, sitting down at those meetings, for example, one thing that came up is it seemed absurd in a way that, you know, you have like nurses who are looking after surgical patients for whatever amount of time you want to call it, 23 hours and 55 minutes out of the day, 57 minutes out of the day, 59 minutes if the surgical team's running really quick, with really never any clear communication between like the nursing staff and the surgical team. And back then, you know, there was nothing like, So that was the underlying problem. So then we had some meetings with frontline nurses, residents, surgeons to be like, what can we do? This doesn't make sense. Like, what can we do? So, you know, so, like there were multiple things that came out of that. One of those things was before it became kind of fashionable at a hospital, we started these kind of, we call them like, I can't remember what kind of rounds we call them, but we had these rounds where basically surgical team would be there and you know, every nurse would come and talk about the patients they were looking after and run through it with the entire team. So OT, PT, dietitian, everyone would be there and kind of talk about the plan and what the discharge plan was. Now, this morphed into discharge rounds. And you know, like these floor huddles became a thing, which again got piloted then on our floors, which were already doing it. So it was a quick win for the hospital and then spread across the whole hospital. Now, I think that again was recognized probably at multiple centers at that time, and it's probably become a thing that's in most hospitals now. But back then, that was something like, you know, without sitting down, like that whole communication piece, you know, you talk about patient care, that's one thing. But also, like, we did a, you know, we actually checked what the culture of the floor was and how nurses and residents found it before and after. And it made a huge difference, actually, to the way nurses felt. And even 3 years later, our results dropped off a bit, which spoke to the fact we need to keep on concentrating on stuff, but it was still significantly better than at baseline in terms of nurses feeling like their ideas were heard and stuff like that. And then that's where you kind of build culture, et cetera.
You know, you've given us so many pearls, and you've very eloquently talked about so much stuff. I want to maybe hit or unpack that term culture, because I think that's, at least in my mind, really the key to continuous and progressive and long-term change. One of your many administrative titles is the vice chair in quality. So obviously a high-end leadership position, and you've outlined how you used cusp and sort of a bottom-up and out approach to engage the folks that, you know, that are stakeholders and maybe historically haven't been stakeholders and should be stakeholders going forward. We also talk a lot in this podcast about, you know, leadership and teamwork and what those definitions really mean and who does it well. So I'm curious, from your sort of vice chair leadership view of things, how is it that you really inspire change in culture in your environment? And I know that's a very broad 30,000-foot question, but what are the nuances if Amir wants to sit down with Morad Hamid in Vancouver and really pursue the same directive, or we want to do it here in Calgary in the same way that you've done it? What are the nuts and bolts of that?
I would track this back, and I wish I had this article in front of me, but in, you know, one really fun magazine to read or journal to read every once in a while is the Harvard Business Review. And in 2014, they had this really nice article on what companies do to improve culture that drives quality. And the number one thing you just spoke about is, for example, you know, you speak to someone like Morad. So you get leadership emphasis on this. Then the second piece of that is you get kind of credible messaging around it. So, for example, you know, let's say, you know, decide Amir is going to start running, you know, improving communication with surgical staff. Well, you know, if Amir is the guy who's constantly berating the entire team, and I can say this because I know Amir is like super nice guy, you know.
Oh, he's terrible. He's terrible. Yeah, exactly, he's terrible. Holy mackerel.
But, you know, like, exactly. So, you know, you need credible messengers for sure. So you need that leadership emphasis, you need the credible messengers. And then, you know, the big piece in that article came down to, and they looked across like healthcare organizations, business organizations, everything. And it was like, it was basically employee ownership and kind of keeping peers accountable. And I think that's where, you know, you talk about, like, the thing I always keep in mind with QI, whether it's culture, whether it's a SSI thing or a communication, is Don Berwick has great lines. One of his great lines is this: a system produces the results it is designed to produce. So if you want to create a system, let's say at a departmental level, where you have employee ownership, you have peer-to-peer kind of pressure on performing quality stuff, then to me, that means you need some way to engage that frontline, to have their ideas heard in a credible way. You need people leading those teams who are credible. And then you need the leadership people to buy into it. And that's what kind of, you know, that's why I think CUSP kind of worked, because yeah, that frontline, you had an executive sponsor, and in teams that worked, and not all our teams worked, right? I mean, we've failed lots of times. You know, sometimes that credible messenger was not there. But, you know, and part of that messaging as well, just in terms of QI building culture, et cetera, is not being afraid to not, to fail. Like, you know, one thing I always throw up in my presentations is, and I stole this from Cliff Coe, I told him I'd steal it from him. He, you know, he runs like the ACS NISQIP program. He gave this great analogy of like, you know, to like a great Canadian analogy, which is if you wanna score a goal in hockey, you gotta get shots on goal. Get shots on goal, I think you need a team. And then, you know, as part of that team, you need to realize not all your shots are gonna go in. And so like to me, CUSP is that team and stuff. And yeah, and so I think those would be the critical pieces to kind of moving things forward.
Yeah, that's well said. I mean, I think Cliff Coe has delivered more practice changing advice in his you know, moderate career than most of us together will do in a lifetime. He's an amazingly smart guy who's changed the world. Yeah, very cool guy. You know, maybe the last question that we would like to ask on the QI side of things, or the continuous QI side of things, which I absolutely love and will start to use, is if you're a resident or a trainee or even a faculty, what are some of the training access points that you can improve your knowledge and your understanding besides going to a NISQIP conference? You know, and obviously the background is, you know, you're MPH and we have a number of surgeons of our vintage across the country now that have done formal masters in QI. But beyond that, where can we access that kind of information and training?
So, I mean, for example, IHI has a great online, and a lot of it is free, modules to kind of learn, like, oh, you know, here, this is what a PDSA cycle is, for example. You know, there's all sorts of different, like, fellowships which people don't need to kind of leave for a long period of time. Like back in the day, like when I started to get serious about stuff, I did one with the American Hospital Association, National Patient Safety Foundation. That's possible for residents as well. You know, there are opportunities like through IHI and stuff. So there's so much stuff, and the online stuff just continues to explode, especially with COVID, right? With all the virtual stuff that's available now. So I think where people are interested, they're, I mean, as long as you've got, you know, and I guess like it's time, right? Which is, I have to throw this line in just because I've been doing Peloton recently. Jess Sims always says time is a non-renewable resource. So, I mean, it's precious stuff, right? But like, if you have the time to put towards something you really care about or passionate about like this, then yeah, doing some of that stuff online, I think would be a great way to start. And then I think a lot of it is like practical stuff, like, you know, learning about change management as well. So there's the QI stuff, but if you don't know about Cotter's steps of change, I think, and you're trying to create change, then I think you need to educate yourself just a little bit more, you know? And again, like those HBR articles, like, I mean, his is the first article in their little change book, but yeah, there's so much, there's just so much knowledge out there, right? And it's, and I mean, you just talk to someone in the field, I think is the best way to start, because then they can point you to stuff which they think is relevant and will hopefully make your learning a little bit more efficient.
You know, one of the really interesting things I think in the last, you can correct me if I'm off a bit, but 5 to 8 years is your Ottawa groups have really started to look at preoperative anemia. And obviously I'm hooked in with the HPV colleagues that you have, but I was wondering if you could sort of talk about that a little bit and where you guys have been and where you're going with that topic in general.
Yeah. Well, thanks for asking about that. So again, along this theme of QI, right, we started to look at, you know, what can we do? So we did a lot of stuff in the OR, like closing trays and wound protectors, which we actually got that idea from HPV. And then we started looking at preoperative kind of optimization. So, you know, great anesthetist here, great researcher, Dan McIsaac, who, you know, I've been lucky enough to work with on frailty. And then we started to look at other modifiable factors. So, you know, what are things that you can like fix and have an impact that are based on evidence? Well, smoking is one of those things. So we worked on that. And your journal, Dr. Ball, has been kind enough to accept that. So hopefully that stuff on smoking cessation will be out soon. Another area was, kind of a little bit more controversial, but one of our CUS teams in actually gynae oncology worked on it, was glycemic control. So we got some stuff instituted on that, kind of department-wide. And then, when we start looking at stuff, I went to this talk, and it was, and I wish I could remember her name, it was a hematologist in Toronto, and she's awesome, does all sorts of stuff. And I realized, like, she gave this talk about anemia and all the impact that it has. And it just blew me away because, I used to see like a hemoglobin of 105. I'd be like, yeah, it's fine. Or like if they have 90, I'd send it to internal medicine. I'd be like, yeah, you know what? We'll give them a transfusion in the OR when they're put to sleep. So they weren't doing anything about it either. And because this anemia area was kind of an orphaned area because no one really was owning it. So that's kind of what struck the kind of interest in that. So initially it was QI, looking at our SSIs, working on stuff, and then kind of moving to like some preventative, I guess, medicine type stuff. And that was kind of part of the bundle that we looked at.
All right. To continue our Peloton meta narrative, we'll switch gears again and talk about something that I think is really unique to the Ottawa Colorectal Group, which is your shared practice. And, to paraphrase Top Knife, your group actually has a shared practice, which is one of those things that's often drawn or talked about, but rarely photographed. Can you describe for our listeners, what exactly does your practice look like and how exactly does a shared practice work?
So I started solo practice and then the HPB group, got to give full credit to that. I'm going to shout out one of my best friends forever, Fatty Bala. He was doing that in HPB. And so I looked at that and I was like, and we were chatting, we chat all the time. We're like, got to do this in colorectal. And so one piece, and I'm sure you guys know this already, but if you're ever recruiting people and you have the privilege to do that, it's very simple for me anyway. Every colorectal surgeon that I've recruited into our group, I clearly believe, and it is bearing out to be true, that they are better than me and will like exceed me in every way. So that was my real only hiring criteria. So the bar was set pretty low there, but like these guys are awesome. So I got a special shout out to Isabel Raich, Lar Williams, Riley Musselman. Those are that's like my work family and actually family even outside of work. So, but started sole practice and Isabel Raich was the first person in. And then Lara was added pretty soon after that, and after that, Riley. And I'll tell you, from going from me and Isabel, we got almost another full surgeon's worth of resources. It wasn't quite two FTEs, let's put it that way. And what we did was we basically have one central line comes in. Either of us will see that person in clinic. Either of us would operate on it. And then that quickly evolved to the same model with Lara, except when Lara came, we got maybe another half surgeon's worth of resources. Okay, so now we're sitting at about 2.5 surgeons worth of resources for 3 people. Not bad. And I mean, that gives you some flexibility to do stuff that you want to do, like QI and these guys have all done amazing stuff outside of just clinical stuff. And then when we hired Riley, we basically didn't get anything. But we made a decision. We really liked Riley. We wanted to hire him on. And we had enough non-clinical things we were doing that we were happy. And number one, to get a pay cut, because we got, there's resources at the end are what generate money. There's money for other things like being program director of general surgery, like Lara is. But at the end of the day, it was pay cut for all of us, but an intentional one. And the way we work now is essentially, let's say, Amir, you come in tomorrow into a cancer clinic. You may see any of the 4 of us. Now, usually, maximum, there's usually 2 of us in clinic, sometimes 3 of us in clinic. But so you may see any of the 4 of us in clinic. And then your surgery may be done by surgeon number 2. And then you may be rounded on by surgeon number 3. And then when you come back to have your pathology reviewed, that may be surgeon number 4. So that we kind of take a week at a time rounding on the floor. So we're rounding 1 weekend out of every 4. We take our turn on going through the paperwork that comes in, like in terms of triaging the referrals that come to our office and stuff like that. And, blood work that comes in on patients and stuff. That would be the kind of the main piece. Oh, and we have a shared administrative unit. So we have two admin assistants for the four of us. And again, everything is just central queue for scopes, for ORs, just next surgeon available goes in.
I think probably that's more and more common, at least elements of that. And if you look across the country, you know, acute care surgery, trauma surgery are probably the forefathers and foremothers of that model to some extent. And you guys are really taking it on the scheduled or elective side to the next level for sure. I'm curious though, how do you articulate that those transitions and that overall care model to the patients? Is it something that you verbalize when you meet them in clinic, or is it an information package that they take home with them, or is it stated when they come in? Where does that sort of back and forth interaction happen, firstly? And then secondly, how do you handle it when there is a problem? Maybe that requires more detailed or more long-term continuity. And maybe it's not even a problem. Maybe it's just complexity, whatever the driver would be.
From the messaging standpoint, our office messages that as soon as patients enter the system, they know they're told it's going to be any one of the four surgeons that will see them, and that they're looked after by a team. And that's what we message to them as well, is that basically, instead of receiving care from one surgeon, they're receiving care from a team of surgeons. And I'll tell you, the vast majority of patients, they buy into that, first of all. And then some of them actually articulate the fact that they've had surgeries before, but they really love the fact that they've got this team that's there. Because, I mean, no matter how awesome that one individual is, it's really tough for that person to be available 365 days a year. And I mean, that's really what we have. You know, we have a backup colorectal call for when, you know, when it, if, so when general surgeons on call, HPB surgeons on call, like if there's an issue that requires nuanced care, they know that, like there's a call schedule that's put out for subspecialty with, you know, our names on it. So there's care for that too. That's much easier to service as a group versus an individual. And then, you know, the second part of your question in terms of complexity, and, you know, I think complexity, first of all, arises, I guess, very quickly in my mind as I'm answering. It's like two scenarios. Like one is you get initial elective complex cases, in which case having input, an instant second opinion in clinic, et cetera, is invaluable. And I think when you look at literature around, even in the business world around people who become more senior, the decision-making is actually sometimes worse because, you know, people may have thoughts up to that point, but then it's that single person that's kind of making that final decision. And so they found that by having more of this group decision-making, you actually make better decisions. That's one in like more of an elective type setting. But even when you get complications, you can always go back to that group. Like we have teaching sessions every Friday morning where we discuss complicated cases if there are any that we need to discuss. But also on the floor, I'll tell you, as a solo surgeon, and Chad, you probably don't have this problem, but man, I've had some complications. And some of those complications stay in for a really long time. And rounding on those people, it's tough. And, you know, part of the toughness of it is, one, I mean, it's tough. But the second part is, like, you know, you almost sometimes lose that perspective. And by us kind of changing every week, it doesn't stop you from coming back to round if you want to, but there's someone in charge that week, and they bring that fresh perspective, right? So it's kind of like this renewed thing. Like I used to do pelvic exonerations by myself. Well, guess what? Now we always make sure there's two of us booked. Guess what? Like when I'm hungry for lunch, probably, I don't know if I was doing as good surgery for that patient, but I can now step out for half an hour if I want. And my partner is going to be, I know they're, well, in my case, I know they're going to do a better job than I am. So I can step out and then I can come back in, and they're going to be there till the end of that case. So even when we're closing fascia, hopefully, you know, between two staff and of course our awesome fellows and residents, like we're going to do the best job possible.
We've had David Urbach come in and talk about this on the podcast as well. And I think there's a lot of value in thinking about having a model like this, particularly as we now think about trying to catch up with this COVID backlog. So, you know, I think it's really super important, I think, for groups to think about how they can optimize their flow. But I think it does require a big mental change. And you've demonstrated this throughout our conversation, but it requires huge humility to say, you know what, I'm certainly not necessarily better than my colleagues. And secondly, that they can do just as good or a better job than I. You know, it's not like, you know, my dad used to say that, one of his mentors used to say, these hands are for this operation. But you know, that mentality kind of has to go. So I am curious, though, like I was lucky enough to spend some time with you, and you as a group, you're such a great collaborative group. You talk to each other so well. You clearly like each other. What happens if you have a dispute or sort of a difference of opinion about how to manage a certain patient or manage a complication, or just generally have a difference in approach on a specific situation? How do you kind of resolve that difference?
Yeah, you know, like that happens, right? I mean, it'd be impossible for that not to happen. But I think, you know, it's that. So I think, you know, we just Terry Zweep, one of our fellows, we just did this kind of scoping review on group practice. And, you know, one of our findings was obviously, look, personality is a big thing. You get the wrong personality and that can actually take away from your quality of life within a group. So I say that because picking those people is super important. And the reason why, I think, is exactly these type of scenarios where you can have a very clear, open, honest discussion about what you think in a safe space, and arrive at a consensus. And that's usually what happens, right? Because again, I think we're all there, just like, you know, the vast majority of people in medicine and surgery, we're there to help people. And so we're trying to arrive at a conclusion that we think is going to help the most. And usually through consensus, especially, you know, with the relationship that we have built over these years and the trust, is, you know, we can arrive at that, and we can pivot. And change. And I think that for me makes me a better person and surgeon for sure.
Do you think that it shifts your relationship with your patients? Like, you know, you've done both solo practice and obviously now the shared model. And there is a sense of having ownership over the patient. This is my patient. I'm going to look after them. You know, whatever happens, I'm going to take care of it. Do you lose that at all? Or is there a sense sort of like, these are all my patients and I have to kind of take care of them as if they're all my patients kind of thing? Like, can you talk about that relationship?
Yeah, no, I think it's exactly what you said. You know, the latter piece is they're all our patients. And you know what? Like, it feels a lot better that I have we're a team and we're looking after all these patients, and those patients know that they've got a team that is looking after them. And so I think, it's a great thing. Like I said, I think it's great for patient care. I think it's great for surgeon lifestyle. You know, you look at, there was that survey, you know, that came out, I'm sure you guys are aware of like the biggest regrets that retired surgeons have had, right? And number one was not spending enough time with their family. And number two was like, they'd want a less stressful practice environment. And I would say, you know, group practice hits number one and number two perfectly. And so, you know, I think when I look back at my career, one of the best things that'll come out of this is this group practice, and being so thankful that, you know, I was able to have partners to do that with.
So now here comes a real serious question. When things are going down in the OR and things are tough, what is the music you're going to put in the OR? I know the answer. Dude, that's, to this.
You know the answer, man. It's Drake all the way. Okay. All the way, man. But the great thing about Drake is Drake knows when I'm in trouble, man, and he comes on the playlist. My playlist at random. The residents of Fells don't believe it, man, until they experience it. You have to experience it to understand that the sixth god also has jurisdiction in my OR.
Okay, why Drake? I mean, I know you're from Toronto and you're brown like I am, and so all, you know, it's ticking all those boxes, but why Drake? Why do you like Drake so much?
Drake's awesome.
Like, why not Kendrick Lamar? Or
is Kendrick Lamar Canadian?
No.
Okay, man. There's your answer. No, so like Drake's Canadian, he's awesome. I like his music. He's proud, man. He's proud to be Canadian. He's like proud of Toronto. He's like, I think he has a lot of Canadian pride, man. You know, when a medical student asked me today why I, you know, like, did I ever think about working in the States? And I was like, you know what? No. You know why? Because I'm Canadian, man. Like, I want to give back to, like, my country, man. Like, this is where I want to be. And this is where Drake wants to be too, man. So I'll tell you, Justin Bieber, also Canadian, also awesome. I know people like to hate on him. He's awesome too. That guy's the demigod of my award. So, you know, when there's like kind of minor problems, Justin will come out and he'll help. So,
That's fantastic. I love it. I also have to just ask you, and maybe this is an even more difficult question than the last one, but you know, we've had long conversations about philosophy when I was there on elective. And so I'm curious, who's your favorite philosopher and why?
That, you know, man, that's a really tough question, right? Like, there's so much good stuff. I'll tell you the stuff that really got me hooked. I love the dialogues between, you know, like that Plato's written up between Plato and Socrates. The cave analogy is something that I think really resonates with my worldview. You know, I think everyone should read the cave analogy. I mean, my daughters read the cave analogy. I love Stoicism too. I love the Meditations by Marcus Aurelius. You know, so much smart stuff there, right? And, I mean, I guess if I had to pick one thing and one, you know, it would be that cave analogy that that Plato wrote up, and I think that'd be my favorite piece of philosophy. But I mean, so much other good stuff out there, right? Like Eudaimonia. I mean, you know, fulfilling life through Aristotle talks about all that stuff. It's all good, but if there's one, just like there can only be, you know, there's just that one god of my war, Drake. Guess it's got to be that.
Oh, I love it. I love it. I couldn't agree more. Marcus Aurelius never leaves my nightstand. So I hear you there. If you were to go back in time and give the younger you some sage advice, what would you tell yourself?
You know, I'm gonna say, give myself the advice that I think I've taken to heart and that Eric Poulin gave me. I remember I was in a cafeteria at St. Mike's in Toronto, my third year residency, when I was doing my research there to try and nail that MIS fellowship. And it's very simple. And he said, you know, make sure every year you do one new thing. And he's like, it doesn't have to be surgical. You know, it doesn't need to be like picking up a new surgical technique or something, but he's like, do one new thing every year. And that will, again, sustain you and keep you from getting bored. And man, I have really conscientiously tried to do that. And I would say that out of almost anything has really kept things interesting for me. And so one new thing every year. I think that would be the advice I would encourage everyone to. And I, you know, like, and just to give you an example, like, you know, it could be like one year it was like doing that QI leadership fellowship thing. You know, one year it was doing Leadership Academy. One year it was like starting up TEM at my institution. You know, for a couple years I counted doing my MPH. So, you know, this year it's really working on global health and really pushing that part of stuff, which I haven't really done before, but that's going to be my thing in 2021. And that would be it.
You've been listening to Cold Steel. the official podcast of the Canadian Journal of Surgery. If you've liked what you've been listening to, please leave us a review on iTunes. We'd love to hear your comments and feedback, so feel free to email us at podcast.cjs@gmail.com or connect with us on Twitter @CanJSurge. Thanks again.